of the audience that are supporters, and we just like to increase that number as much as we possibly can. So that's why this week, this first fundraising effort of the year, we're hoping to enroll 300 new friends. And if we did do that, if we got 300 new people, and if they just joined at the basic membership level, that would mean $12,000, a shot into our budget. And, of course, if you could give a little bit more than $40, that would be even better. The important thing is that we can count you among this group of people that we call the Friends of WILL. Friends not just because they think we're nice. I know they like the programs, but they're friends because they're actually – they understand their role is to be actively involved, not just listening and not just maybe calling sometimes, but also helping to pay the cost of keeping the place going. That's easy to do right now. 244-9455 is the number.
Can I just mention something, too?
Yeah,
you know, if you are, say, a member of the university here and you're not a contributor, one of the things I do for my contribution to the station is I have it taken out of my my paycheck every month. And you can – I'll just say you can contribute a lot more than $40 and not even notice it because you're just taking it out a small amount every month. And that's one way to not even be aware of the fact that you're really contributing to the health of the station. So that – you know, instead of saying, oh, I can't do it because I don't have the money this month or that seems like a lot, you know, for one fell swoop, just – you know, you can play it out, you know, a little bit, a drip and a drab, you know, every month, and it'll come up to something very nice, and it's a good support for
the
station.
Yeah, that's excellent thought. It's a good system. Yeah. You can definitely do that as a payroll deduction. And that way you could, for example, somebody could give $120 and do that $10 a month.
$10 a month is,
That's not very much.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And again, this morning, if people call in and if you make a contribution at the basic level or above, $40 or better, we'll send you a book with our thanks. You may choose, I'm sorry we can't let you choose the title, but trust us, they're good books. They're recent. We've taken good care of them. They're in hardcover, and you may choose either a fiction or nonfiction book, and we'll send it to you with our thanks. So let me just give the pledge number again, 244-9455. 217 is the area code to call in and make a pledge. And then, of course, on this show, if you want to call in and recommend a book, you can do that too. So when we were talking before, we had to pause because we needed to.
We've never done this before. This sort of transition over into the second hour with the same author. Yeah.
So Philip mentioned a novel called Glyph that he liked very much.
Percival Everett.
Percival Everett. Now, and Tanya also has a book by Percival Everett.
She's going to let me read one more mention of the conversation, and then
yes,
she's going to jump in. Yeah. This one is between Socrates and James Baldwin.
A couple of regular guys.
Yeah. It starts out, I end up hating Socrates because he talks with such condescension to the great James Baldwin. He calls his, tell me, Jimmy. You know? Socrates, tell me, Jimmy, how do things go these days? Baldwin, things go fine. Socrates, you know, I envy you your art, being able to create a world, build people, lie the way you do so convincingly. Baldwin, I wouldn't call it lying. Socrates, very well, but I have a question for you. He's going to have a Socratic dialogue here. You create a world, and to do that, you have to draw on the world we know and then recreate. Is that close to correct? Baldwin, more or less. Socrates, so, in order to render a world as you do, you must fully comprehend the world from which you draw your material and substance. The emphasis here being on fully. Baldwin, actually, it is the act of creating the world of my fiction that allows me to understand the so-called real world.
Yeah.
Socrates, but how can that be when the real world is the one you need before you begin your art? Suppose a man wanted to write a novel, but he knew nothing of the world. Could he do it? Baldwin, why would such a man seek to write a novel? Socrates, just suppose that he did. Baldwin, I can't suppose that. Socrates, let's try it this way. Suppose I understand the world completely. By virtue of that fact, would I necessarily be able to write a novel? Baldwin, why would you want to? Socrates, but suppose I did want to. Baldwin, then you'd have no need for writing a novel. Socrates, suppose I didn't need to, but just wanted to write a novel. Baldwin, then you wouldn't understand the world.
Wow.
I like that.
See,
a lot.
That's why the guy is so great.
Yes, he's
great. He is great. Yeah.
he's wonderful.
He has these little lines that just he sums things up so well and without any kind of pretension or, you know, he
Right to the heart.
Yep.
And I love it again that Baldwin is kicking Socrates.
Right.
I just love it because Baldwin is, I think, deeply underestimated. I think he's one of the great, great writers of the 20th century. He's my favorite American
writer. He's your favorite American writer.
Of the 20th century, he's it,
now
man,
that is a statement.
He's great. Yeah. So so I'm glad he kicked Socrates' butt.
I see a theme here of writers kicking non-writers' butt.
I think that's just coincidence.
That's the pleasure of Percival Everett's writing this book in some sense.
Okay.
But I like non-writers. I'm not an aggressive type of person. Anyway, so.
So now, Tanya.
Yes.
He has another
book.
Collection.
This is a collection by the same writer, Percival Everett. It's called Damned If I Do. And each one, I mean, they're just little gems in here. And I love the form. I love short fiction. It's pretty much my absolute favorite thing. And just, you know, in a few minutes, sometimes even in just a couple of minutes, you have a complete experience, you know. So I really enjoy short stories. And he is with the same kind of humor and sort of sarcasm that he uses in this book. He does the same thing with these stories. And the story I'm going to read from is called The Appropriation of Cultures. And it's about a young man who lives in South Carolina. His name's Daniel. And he doesn't really have to work because his mom left him some money. And he loves jazz. And he goes to this little bar, a little jazz bar in South Carolina on the weekends to play music with this group of old jazz musicians. And when he's there one evening, a group of white fraternity boys, drunken fraternity boys, come in and start chanting for him to sing Dixie. Mm-hmm. Sing Dixie for us. Yeah. Play Dixie. And when they're finished, so he plays it, and he plays it seriously. He plays it hard, and he plays it well, and he plays it in a serious tone. And he does a great job. And the kids, as they're leaving, the college kids, slap him on the back. You know, great job and all that. So this is right after that occurs. Daniel didn't much care for the slaps on the back, but he didn't focus too much energy on that. He was busy trying to sort out his feelings about what he had just played. The irony of his playing the song straight and from the heart was made more ironic by the fact that as he played it, it came straight and from his heart. As he was claiming southern soil, or at least recognizing his blood in it. He was the land of cotton and hell. His was the land of cotton and hell, no, it was not forgotten. At 23, his anger was fresh and typical, and so was his ease with it, the way it could be forgotten for chunks of time, until something like that night with the white frat boys, or simply a flashing blue light in the rearview mirror, brought it all back. He liked the song, wanted to play it again. He knew that he would. He drove home from the bar on Green Street and back to his house where he made tea and read about Pickett's charge at Gettysburg while he sat in the big leather chair that had been his father's. He fell asleep and had a dream in which he stopped Pickett's men on the Emmitsburg Road on their way to the field and said, "Give me back my flag." So what he does is he's hanging out on his front porch, right, with his best friend who's a woman, and he needs a truck. Decides he needs to buy a new truck. And he's going through like the whatever thrifty nickel or whatever it is he's got there looking for an automobile. And he comes across one that's the right price, the right year, the right mileage. He says, great. So he calls up the guy and makes an appointment to come and look at the truck. Travis and Barb lived across the river in the town of Irmo, a name that Daniel had always thought suited a disease for cattle. He drove around the maze of tract homes until he found the right street and number. A woman in a housecoat across the street watched from her porch, safe inside the chain-link fence around her yard. From down the street, a man and a teenager, who were covered with grease and apparently engaged in work on a torn-apart Dodge Charger, mindlessly wiped their hands and studied him. Daniel walked across the front yard, through a maze of plastic toys, and knocked on the front door. Travis opened the door and asked in a surly voice, "What is it?" "I called about the truck," Daniel said. "Oh, you're Dan?" Daniel nodded. "The truck's in the backyard. Let me get the keys." He pushed the door to, but it didn't catch. Daniel heard the quality of the exchange between Travis and Barb, but not the words. He did hear Barb say as Travis pulled open the door, "I couldn't tell over the phone." "Got him," Travis said. "Come on with me." He looked at Daniels Jensen as they walked through the yard. "What kind of car is that?" "It's a Jensen." "Nice looking. Is it fast?" "I guess." The truck looked a little rough, a pale blue with a bleached out hood and a crack across the top of the windshield. Travis opened the driver's side door and pushed the key into the ignition. "It's a strong runner," he said. Daniel put his hand on the faded hood and felt the warmth, knew that Travis had already warmed up the motor. Travis turned the key and the engine kicked over. He nodded to Daniel. Daniel nodded back. He looked up to see a blonde woman looking on from behind the screen door of the back porch. "The clutch and the alternator are new this year." Travis stepped backward to the wall of the bed and looked in. "There's some rust back here, but the bottom's pretty solid." Daniel attended to the sound of the engine. "Misses just a little," he said. "A tune-up will fix that." Daniel regarded the rebel flag decal covering the rear window of the cab, touched it with his finger. "That thing will peel right off," Travis said. "No, I like it." Daniel sat down in the truck behind the steering wheel. "Mind if I take it for a spin?" "Sure thing." Travis looked toward the house, then back to Daniel. "The brakes are good, but you gotta press hard." Daniel nodded. Travis shut the door, his long fingers wrapped over the edge of the half-lowered glass. Daniel noticed that one of the man's fingernails was blackened. "I'll just take it around a block or two." The blonde woman was now standing outside the door on the concrete steps. Daniel put the truck in gear and drove out of the yard, past his car and down the street by the man and teenager who were still at work on the charger. They stared at him, were still watching him as he turned right at the corner. The truck handled decently, but that really wasn't important. So what happened is that he takes this truck for a drive, and he decides he's going to reclaim the Confederate flag. And what he does is he drives around with it, and people, you know, stare at him and think he's, you know, strange. And actually a group of black kids comes out in a parking lot and says, you know, "What the hell's going on?" Mm-hmm. And he says, "Hey, you know, power to the people, brother," you know. And they're like, "What's going on?" And the wife of the guy that sold the truck says to him, you know, "I don't understand why you want that sticker, mm-hmm. why you want to keep it." Yeah. And he basically tells her, "Well, why not? You know, I'm a Southern boy, you know, fly it proud." And he just kind of reclaims it. And what he finds by the end of the story is that,
Okay.
So, yeah. So what happens is not so much that others have adopted, that mm-hmm. other black people have adopted using the sticker, but that the white people have peeled them all off. Right. He basically does away with the Confederate flag in his town by claiming it for his people. You know, so it's really, you know, and he does, and all of his stories are like this.
Yeah. He's
terrific. He's just,
Yeah. Very good. Okay, his name again?
Percival Everett.
Yeah. Very good.
One V, one R, two T's.
He's a fabulous writer, and he's got like 12 books, so you have a lot of pleasure ahead of you if you're just discovering him. I know. I do.
Very good. Our guests, let me just reintroduce for anybody who might not know who these two are, Tanya Leosakis and Philip Graham. Philip is a professor of English at U of I and is a writer. Tanya works at Pages for All Ages Bookstore, and for, you know, quite a while now, periodically, several times a year, we ask them to come in and talk about what they have been reading, and they always bring new books. Generally, they talk about fiction. Every once in a while, something that's nonfiction, but pretty much what they're interested in is reading novels and collections of stories. So they bring in books and they say, "Look, here's something I've read. I thought this was really good. I'll tell you a little bit about it. Not too much, but I'll tell you a little bit about it. And maybe you would like it." So that's what we do with the program when they are on. And it's always fun to have them here. And also, people who are listening, you can do the same if you want. You know, if you, there's a book that you've read, and it doesn't even have to be new book, just a book that you've read that you thought was really good, you can call in and recommend it. So now we'll go back to Philip.
We're on the subject of short stories. I'd like to recommend a story collection called Among the Missing by a writer named Dan Chan, C-H-A-O-N. He's actually coming to give a reading on campus here next Tuesday at 4:30 at the Atlanta Union Bookstore. And actually, he's going to be staying with us for 2 weeks. And this is a wonderful story collection. I love the title, Among the Missing, because so many of the people in these stories are missing. They're missing. They haven't somehow managed to escape the past, and they're still obsessed with a past incident or someone who has passed away and so forth. And there's something essential about them is missing in their present day lives. They have private lives that the ones that people around them don't know. And another way of reading among the missing is they are themselves among the missing. They are among the people who have died. They're among the people who are set in the past. They're living so intently in there. And it was hard to try to figure out which story to read from, because they're all so beautifully written and powerful. But I thought I'd try Big Me. I love the title of it anyway, Big Me. And there's a boy here who later on in the story from after the section that I read sees a new person come into town who he's absolutely positive is looks just like he would look if he were grown up. Mm-hmm. And he begins to wonder if this is him from the future coming mm-hmm. down to give him a warning, and he starts spying on this guy. But here's a child with a very well-developed imagination. It all started when I was 12 years old. Before that, everything was a peaceful blur of childhood, growing up in the small town of Beck, Nebraska. A town, we called it. Really, the population was just less than 200. And it was one of those dots along Highway 30 that people didn't usually even slow down for, though strangers sometimes stopped at the little gas station near the grain elevator or ate at the cafe. My mother and father owned a bar called the Crossroads at the edge of town. We lived in a little house behind it, and behind our house was the junkyard, and beyond that were wheat fields, which ran all the way to a line of bluffs and barren hills full of yucca and rattlesnakes. Back then, I spent a lot of time in my mind building a city up toward those hills. This imaginary place was also called Beck, but it was a metropolis of a million people. The wise, though cowardly, mayor lived in a mansion in the hills above the interstate, as did the bullish, Teddy Roosevelt-like police commissioner Winthrop Golding. There were other members of the rich and powerful who lived in enormous old Victorian houses among the bluffs, and many of them harbored dreadful secrets or were involved in one way or another with the powerful Beck underworld. One wealthy, respectable citizen, Mr. Caraffa, turned out to be a lycanthrope who preyed on the lovely virginal junior high school girls, mutilating them beyond recognition, until I shot him with a silver bullet. I was the city detective, though I was often underappreciated, and because of my radical notions in danger of being fired by the cowardly mayor. The police commissioner always defended me, even when he was exasperated by my unorthodox methods. He respected my integrity. I don't know how many of my childhood years existed in this imaginary city. Already by the age of 8, I had become the detective, and shortly thereafter I began drawing maps of the metropolis. By the time we left Beck, I had a folder 6 inches thick, full of street guides and architecture and subway schedules. In the real town, I was known as the strange kid who wandered around talking to himself. Old people would find me in their backyard garden and come out and yell at me. Children would see me playing on their swing sets, and when they came out to challenge me, I would run away. I trapped people's cats and bound their arms and legs, harshly forcing confessions from them. Since no one locked their doors, I went into people's houses and stole things, which I pretended were clues to the mystery I was trying to solve.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the wonderful thing about this book, too, is that these are very sad stories in many ways, a very powerful story, but there's also this thread of humor that runs through them all, the thread of the marvelous imagination. And that's, I think, some of the things that a reader sometimes doesn't know that they're appreciating is that full world in which sadness and humor are all connected together,
sure,
in the same way,
yeah,
you know, and that runs through every page of this book. It's a beautiful book.
Very good. As I mentioned in the first hour, if you have internet access, you can go to our website and we'll have the list. All of the books that we've talked about here this morning will be there, so you can get them. Otherwise, if you don't, well, we'll get that information to you. What we want to do right now is check in with Kim Kronick, who is in Pledge Central, and she's been there. This is it's actually a studio. It's a little recording studio we have, but at Fun Drive time, we turn it into the place where it's our call center, and the volunteers come in, and that's where they wait for the calls. And Kim is stationed down there so she can keep an eye on what's going on while we're here having a good time talking with Philip and Tanya. And we want to find out, have some people been calling in to take advantage of this offer that we've had to send a book with a pledge?
Thank you.
Kim?
Yes, I'm right here. The number to call is 217-244-9455. We've heard from four more people who are getting hardcover fiction or nonfiction books because they call in during Focus 580 and our special book extravaganza crazy giveaway. And we'd like you to get your book as well because we'd like you to become a member of WILL. We rely on members to keep us strong, to keep us going. We are public radio, so we need your voluntary support. $40, like I said, is a basic membership. We'll take your Visa, your MasterCard, Discover, or American Express, or you can pledge on the web, WILL.UIUC.edu, at our secure online site. Please give us a call right now and get your free book and support your public radio station. Yeah.
It's something we've never been shy about. We believe in reading, and we believe in writers, and we believe in books, and we like to promote those things. And this is just, and we're always looking for something that can get people jazzed. I think we know ultimately that people are not making their pledge just so they can get a book. They're making that pledge because they understand their role in supporting the station and keeping it strong. But it is a thing that we can do to thank you as a way of thanks. And you can then take that book and you can read it and then you can pass it on to somebody else and they can read it. It's good recent stuff, fiction, nonfiction. If you can make that pledge at $40 or above, we'll send your book with our thanks. And Harriet tells me already that Harriet Williamson, one of our producers, says the book list from this morning is already on the website. So if you want that information, you can get it. We try to find as many different ways to deliver the basic message as possible. But the simplest and most straightforward way to do it is just to say to people, look, if we're going to maintain the level of service that we have now, and we hope to improve it and find new things that we can do, in the face of that shrinking tax-based support, the money from the state, the federal government, there's no place else we can go. And we really have no other option. And when we do these kinds of fundraising efforts, we sit here in front of the microphone. We're doing that primarily to reach out to people who are not now supporters. We do have people who've supported us for a long time and who understand just how important that is. But this is our opportunity to talk to people, for whatever reason. If you listen to the radio station but you're not a supporter, now would be the time to change that. It would be really great if we could hear from as many people as we possibly can here this morning. If you love books and you love writing and you love to read and you're interested in the kind of programs we do on this show and on the Afternoon Magazine, everything else that public radio is about, you need to be an active supporter of this station. So you can do that. It's very easy. 244-9455. You can give us a call right now. And we do have some more time here with Philip and Tanya, at least another good 20 minutes or so, 20, 25
Great.
Minutes.
Fabulous.
And we'll mention some more books. That's what we do when they are here on the program. We just ask them to come in and tell us about what they have been reading. And they bring things. And people sometimes who are listening call in and they mention their favorites, or sometimes as happened in the first hour of the program, people call in and say, I've read this author, and I really liked that author's work, or I really liked that kind of a story, and I've read everything that there is by that person.
Right. Terrible,
okay,
yeah.
Now you're what gonna, do I do?
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes we've been able to make suggestions like that, too. I think probably people with their kids go through those things
where they
come up to a particular writer, mm-hmm. and they just devour everything.
The whole thing, yeah.
And then
yeah.
they come to the end and say, well, now what am I going to read?
Yeah.
So
there's always someone similar.
There is always. And a great place to go for suggestions for that, of course, is, you can go to your favorite bookstore.
Yeah.
You can also go to the library.
How about that?
What a concept.
Yeah.
The library,
They know something about books over there.
They do.
That's what I hear.
Believe me, they do. Okay. So let me see. I guess maybe we'll come back to Tanya.
Okay. I couldn't remember if I'd recommended this book before or not.
I don't think so.
No. Okay. Yeah. It's just been a while since I read it, but it was so good that I have to make sure I get it on the air. It's called The Dogs of Babel by Carolyn Parkhurst, and it is a novel. I'm just going to set it up. The setup is a man gets a call from his home, and it's a policeman who's in his home. And he says, there's been an emergency, there's been an accident, you need to come home. So he comes home, and he discovers that his wife is dead in the backyard under a big tree. And what's happened is she's either jumped or fallen or been pushed out of this tree. Somehow, this is how the accident has happened. And she broke her neck. So she's dead. And the cops, the forensics people sort of think that she wasn't a suicide because something about, like, when you jump from a height, you usually break your ankles, apparently, because it's your instinct to attempt to land on your feet. And since she didn't have broken ankles, they sort of suspected that it wasn't a suicide, and they didn't, you know, do you have any enemies and all that kind of thing. The only witness to any of this, there were no neighbors home, it was just the worst possible situation. The only witness to any of this was the couple's dog, Lorelei. And they're both very close to the dog. And the husband is a linguist. That's what he does for a living. That's one of the real interesting things in the book, is that you get all this neat stuff about linguists and language, and I love that. And he decides, and you have to, now this is not magical realism. This is straight fiction, you know, supposed to be reality. So you have to, you know, suspend your disbelief a little bit. This is the part at which people say, oh, I don't think that book's for me.
Well, thanks for the warning.
But it is. It certainly is. He decides, he just gets real obsessed, basically, to discover what happened, and he looks for clues. And he decides that he's going to attempt to teach his dog
to talk.
So the dog can tell him what happened.
Right. Now, I will tell you that and I don't think there's ever any question about it in the book, so I don't think I'm giving anything away.
Okay.
The dog never talks. He never gets... Okay, so you don't have to think that it's, you know, a book about a talking dog. It works with cats in the Murakami. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But
I can't believe talking sponges. Talking dogs.
Talking dogs. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Anyway, so he decides this is what he's going to do, and he's read a lot of research about... other people who have tried this, and almost always, see, here's why he's so obsessed. He doesn't just think it was suicide or an accident. He starts to come across things in his home in the weeks following the accidental. Everything seems normal at first, but he starts to come across these tiny little things that you never would really notice right away. Mm-hmm. Like they're big readers, this couple, and they have a house full of books. And what he started to notice was that the books weren't where they were supposed to be. And they weren't organized in any particular way. They're kind of a mess in their house. They don't have them all alphabetized and all of that. Yeah, yeah. But you know, Philip, being in a house full of books, when you walk past, you know, you walk through the hallway and you just happen to notice for whatever reason that poetry collection is next to that book about how to brew beer or, you know, whatever. You just remember that, and it stays with you for whatever reason. And then you see it somewhere else, and you know you haven't touched it. And you know that your wife would never have touched that book. And your books are pretty separate. And he starts to notice that the books have all been slightly rearranged. And he looks for a pattern, and he looks for a pattern, and he looks for clues, right? Man. But he can't.
And he's trying to teach a dog to talk. This is cool.
Well, he doesn't try to teach the dog to talk until after all these things happen. And he goes, you know, there's no way I will ever know unless someone who was here can tell me what happened. And so that's why he becomes obsessed with making the dog talk. Now, what he does is, and he does all these fun little linguistic things with the dog and tries to create a typewriter in which the dog recognizes symbols and all of this fun stuff. But he accidentally gets involved with a group, like a secret group of scientists and linguists who've been working on this problem forever. And you can't really, they've determined that you can't really make a dog talk without altering its vocal cords in some way. You can't make it speak English because it can't make the sounds that we need to speak English. So he ends up at this horrible place, and I won't say anymore.
Where dogs have been
I won't say
surgically
anymore.
Altered.
I won't say anymore.
Man, I don't want to
think of what a dog would say if it could talk.
Well,
it would probably disappoint me, you know?
Oh, you think so? You don't have a dog, do you, Philip?
Well, no, that's probably it.
Yeah.
But wouldn't it revolve around food and sniffing various... I mean...
But the point is that he has the information there.
Okay.
He has the information. Mm-hmm. He saw what happened.
Yeah.
The dog did.
Well, when you're... As a matter of fact, I talked the other day with a man who's a pretty famous psychologist, mm-hmm. who has written a lot about dog behavior.
Yeah.
He's a human psychologist, but he's well known about writing these books about dogs. And he said that he thought that that the average dog had the intelligence of, approximately a two-year-old. Yeah. Well, when your kids were two, they were worth talking to then, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, no, I actually don't mean to come across that way, because I absolutely believe that a wide range of other creatures on this planet are far, far, far more intelligent than we give them credit for. There's a kind of arrogance of saying only humans can do this or feel this or think this. And I think the great barrier to that is, one, the arrogance of our point of view, and two, the great difficulty of translating another species' ways of communication. Mm-hmm. They just realized that birds, I just read this in the New York Times a few weeks ago, that birds' brains are, bird brain, saying that. Birds' brains are actually far larger and more complex than has been reported, previously, that they're actually quite intelligent creatures.
Mm-hmm. I talked to this man, and it brings the story to mind. He tells a story in this book about how people... the ideas that people have about dogs and their intelligence. Mm-hmm. And he was called in. Someone wanted to him to get involved in the Simpson murder case because the only witness apparently was the dog.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so an attorney called him and in all seriousness wanted him to come out and interview the dog.
The dog. Mm-hmm.
And this man, his name is Stanley Coren, mm-hmm. and he's a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia. He apparently just couldn't believe it. And he thought to himself, now, wait a minute, you want me to come out and interview the dog? Yeah. And the lawyer was apparently very, very serious. So Coren was sort of pulling the guy's leg, and he says, well, you mean maybe I could get the dog to bark once for yes and twice for no?
Right.
And the lawyer said, what, you mean you could do that? So some people believe things that just aren't true.
Right.
We have a caller. Why don't we talk with them? We have someone listening this morning in Chicago on our toll-free line right here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a question. I also have a book suggestion. I'm not sure if the lady with the 9-year-old is still listening, but The Shanghai Diary, which the author was on Afternoon Magazine, it's Shanghai Diary by Ursula Bacon. That's the diary of a young girl, a young Jewish girl, who escapes Germany and goes to Shanghai, China. And she's 9 years old when the story starts. And she pretty much writes from a 9-year-old's perspective of what's happening to her. But it's written for adults. And I think it would probably be helpful if you either read it to your child or read it with your child, because it has a lot of really good points of discussion for parents. There's many things that she hides from her parents, either to protect them. And I think that that always happens with kids, things that really could be discussed and maybe the adult would have been able to help them. And I think you can have discussions about that without putting your child on the line. And also there's a lot of material on how to deal with adversity, which I think a lot of kids need, especially with so many parents having economic insecurity. I think that it would be very comforting, very helpful, especially with children who are old enough to understand but don't know how to deal with their worries. So that I think that would be a book where both the parents and the child would enjoy it.
Well, great. Well, thanks for the suggestion.
Yes, and my question is, do you have any recommendations of poetry on CD, really well-done readings of poetry?
There's one that I know of, which is like a big collection. It's both a book and a CD accompanies it, and it's called Poetry Speaks. And I think it's like... nationally renowned poets.
Is there an editor?
Reciting, you might have to. David's going to look it up here and see if we can find it. I have to admit, I haven't listened to it myself, but it's been really successful, and it's a variety of poets. So,
Let's see.
That's it. Yeah.
Elsie Passion, Rebecca Presson Mosby. probably the easiest way is just to go look for the title. And that is what it's titled, Poetry Speaks, Hear Great Poets Read Their Work from Tennyson to Plath. And it's a book, and it includes three audio CDs. And I don't know what else I can tell you about it. It's been out a couple of years, came out in 2001. And the publisher is Source Books Media Fusion.
Okay.
So I would think if the title should be sufficient and you go into a bookstore, they should be able to,
Sounds like a great resource. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's talk with, I think, somebody else here locally. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Garrison Keillor has a poetry collection that he's edited and done, and a variety of people, about five different people read the poems.
I think it's called Good Poems. Is that right?
Yeah, that sounds like
it. Yeah.
And it's a good thing to listen to if you're on a long trip, because if I always fall asleep if I'm if I'm the passenger. So if it's a story, I miss out on the story. But with the poems, you know, if you miss out on some of it, you just missed out on a couple of poems. But that was interesting. I recommend that. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Other questions are welcome, too. Other recommendations as well. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And now, Philip has in his hands
a book of poetry.
A book of poetry.
Perfect segue. This was my next book. This book, for full disclosure purposes, is written by a colleague of mine, Lawrence Lieberman, in the Creative Writing Program here at the University of Illinois. This is his latest book of poetry called The Hour of the Mango Black Moon. And this is a really unusual book. And it's unusual because all the poems are written in response to particular paintings. And the paintings are by three Caribbean painters. One is Stanley Greaves, the other is Ras Akeem, and Ras Ishi. And they're very different artists. And the one thing I love about this book is that virtually every one of
these are beautiful.
They're beautiful. The Stanley Greaves has a kind of a Magritte-ish quality to his work, but it's Caribbean material that he's working from. And then the others are actually quite different, much more abstract.
Mm-hmm.
Or some of them even look like drawings on walls. The artists really kind of – each one is a wonderful artist. And the poems are based on the paintings, and that's why the paintings are in the book, because he follows so closely the energy of – the specific images in the paintings, that you really do want to read the poem, look at the painting, read the poem again. There's a beautiful interaction here. I can't, unfortunately, show a picture over the radio. It's a real problem with this medium. But I'd like to read the beginning and then the end of one of the poems called Door Stoop Amours, which is a picture, again, in a kind of Magritte surrealistic-like quality of a knife that's standing in the doorway of what appears to be the home of a piece of okra, an okra shell, and the okra seems to be female, and the knife seems to be male. So this is from the poem Door Stoop Amours. Mr. Knife has just come to try his luck with the local belle. Tall, elegant Ms. Okra standing upright in the well-lit doorway on her one pointy toe. She's dressed to the brow and maybe waggles ever so slightly those natural long ruffles of her dress. A full bodysuit topped by her stem-like head. He's come a-courtin' and thus salutes her with his vertical white bone handle. And then near the end here, just won't go on. Tallish, svelte okra and her suitor are of similar height, we suppose, though half of his blade leg slinks from view. Closed door in the divided archway to her right is a half slice of brown toast, which is adorned with two buttons lined up as befits a sporty dinner jacket, in place of the usual knocker or metal ornaments. Perhaps Sir Knife pays his visit instead to offer to perform one of his chivalrous popular rites, the spreading of jam or butter on her door of toast.
Can I see the painting again?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, this one, the one that I just read, does not have the painting there, which really bothers me because I've seen the painting and it's wonderful. But you see over again these marvelous paintings of Stanley Greaves in particular.
Yeah, Stanley Greaves, okay.
Yeah, which are both naturalistic and not. And it has that
Magritte is the perfect, very much so, yeah. That's a good description.
And it's a wonderful book of poems, and it's wonderful art. You'll learn a lot about some contemporary Caribbean artists as well that, you know, you would not perhaps normally come in contact with.
And this is Lawrence Lieberman, and Lawrence teaches here at the University of Illinois.
Hour of the Mango Black Moon.
Great title.
Yeah, okay. And the most of the poems are accompanied by the paintings that they describe. So it's a beautiful book, and full color, too. So it's a very beautiful book.
Great. Let's talk with some more people who are out there listening. Champagne, the next caller, line number one.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wanting to ask your guests if they can think of some current writers who have developed what I guess would be sort of a unique style, something, you know, along the lines of, you know, how in the 20th century, Hemingway and people like Joyce and Faulkner, not so much just, you know, plot or even character, but they wrote in a style that, you know, influenced, you know, subsequent writers.
Well, there's a challenge.
Yeah, so something where you could almost recognize the writing.
That's right.
You know who the writer is just from the writing.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, they obviously had a certain way of communicating and writing that was more dominant even than the character or the plot that were part of their writing.
I would say J.M. Coetzee. I'd actually say Murakami.
Milan Kundera. John Updike.
Impossible
to miss.
Right. Yeah, you know that's him.
Yeah.
Philip Roth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like the genetic code is, you know, there in every sentence.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would say a sign of a writer of, you know, a profound vision of some sort in that their being is so encapsulated in the words that come out.
The person that I thought of was Gabriel
Garcia Marquez. Certainly.
But
you always will recognize him.
Yes, but you know what's interesting is a couple of the people, Kundera, who I mentioned, and Garcia Marquez that you mentioned, we know them through translation. And
still somehow,
through translation, the personality comes through. You can, I have a number of books by Kundera, and a number of them are translated by different translators, and yet you give me a paragraph, you got it down. You know who it is.
Yeah. And if you like Gabriel Garcia Marquez and that whole kind of where it's like a soup in your head and you don't know what's happening until it's actually happening, Murakami is the same way.
Yeah.
I mean, very different language,
much
starker language than Garcia Marquez. But
and which of his books would you recommend?
Of Murakami?
Yes.
All of them. The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle.
Right.
This new one, I do think so far is his best, although I suppose I haven't read all of his novels. I enjoyed Norwegian Wood.
Right.
Hard-boiled Wonderland.
And Hard-boiled
the World. And also, he has a short story collection called After the Quake. It's a very short book. It's under 200 pages long.
Little stories.
Little stories and profound stories. It's a stories so elliptical that you really have to pay attention. Though not, I'm not talking about heavy lifting here, but you enter into a world of correspondences that are so slight and yet so important that it's a profoundly moving book. And again, it's very different from his other books as well. He really is a genius.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Well, thank you very much.
Right,
thank you. Thank
well,
you.
Here Celeste is weighed
Jose
in,
Saramago.
And she wants to suggest
I should have said that.
Norman Mailer and Alice Hoffman.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, Alice Hoffman, you can always, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Tanya just said Jose Saramago, the great Portuguese writer, who, again, is impossible.
You can always, impossible to miss.
To
yeah. yeah, yeah.
All right, very good. Well, interesting question. Let's talk with somebody else here. We have someone on a cell phone on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Good morning, David Inch and guests. Your caller would recommend 3 nonfiction titles and then ask a question.
Sure.
The first title is Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World by Jack Weatherford, a Manchester College anthropologist. Genghis Khan informs us of the importance of the 13th century Mongol Empire to an understanding of the history, not only of Asia, but also Europe and our present life. The second title is Blink, B-L-I-N-K, Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking by Malcolm Gladwell, G-L-A-D-W-E-L-L, Gladwell, a New Yorker magazine writer. Blink is concerned with the uncanny accuracy of certain perceptions which draw from the intuitive choosing of just the right factors from the host of possible information upon which the slower-moving brain might perhaps provide less correct perceptions. The third title is The Four Agreements, A Practical Guide to Personal Freedom by Don Miguel Ruiz, R-U-I-Z, Ruiz, a teacher of Toltec wisdom. The Four Agreements presents a straightforward, very brief explication of four principles from which, when we adopt them, impeccable life results. So then the question, what should your caller read next? Thank you.
You know, the Four Agreements, I'll have to say, I admit I haven't read it, but I know about, I have 10 friends, I'd say, at least, who keep trying to influence me to read it. So I I take your suggestion. Other
from
suggestions.
That reading list. Well,
gosh.
You know, there's a new book out, and of course this is terrible because I can remember neither the name of the book nor the author, but it's an Indian writer who is writing, I think it's an Indian writer, I mean, it's a Southeast Asian Indian writer who is writing about Buddhism. He himself is a Hindu, but he's writing about Buddhism. And it's gotten a lot of play. I think it's reviewed recently in the New York Times, New York Magazine, and elsewhere. And he relates sort of the call of Buddhism and sort of the wisdom of Buddhism in a post 9/11 world.
Mm.
And it's gotten some really pretty fabulous reviews.
I don't know where in the bookstore you would go to find it.
But it's
you go to the information desk.
Yeah, or ask a reference librarian, perhaps, because yes. I'm so stupid I can't remember either bit of information for you. But it is getting a lot of reviews recently.
Okay. Well, that's certainly a good thing to do is to look at reviews. Look at the New York Times mm-hmm. book review.
Yeah.
If you are online, you have internet access. You can all the big newspapers will do a lot of book reviews.
Yeah.
There's a publication called Publishers Review.
Yeah.
Publishers
Weekly.
Publishers Weekly. Where they have reviews, and that's basically for people in the business. But also, you can go there and you can get capsule reviews. Publishers
mm-hmm.
Weekly,
yeah.
And it's online too. So there are probably lots of places to go and look for to find out what is new and what's coming out.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do that. I think we're almost at the point where we're going to have to stop.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we would have to promise that. We'll have you come back another time. There's not one more thing that you want to...
I have another poem. That's probably...
Good. Yes, do that.
The thing I have marked is too long.
You sure?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No.
Okay.
Don't be sorry.
This is by the poet Betsy Scholl, S-H-O-L-L. The book is called Late Psalm, P-S-A-L-M. And this is a... poem called At the Public Market. It's someone who is looking at the lobsters in the lobster tank and thinking about mortality. Mm-hmm. At the Public Market. Abandon all hope, reads the hand-scrawled sign propped beside the lobster tank. Some joker brooding on its murky doom, which looks more like the world unformed and void, stirred by a mind feeling that sluggish urge to make itself known. A mind struggling into form, water to gel, to claw and tail, oozing its way out of slime, stumbling among bottom feeders, grovelers, creeps all bunched up, feelers a dither over their futures, watery inferno. How innocent Dante seems at first, trembling and clutching at Virgil his guide, as if he hadn't constructed that bucket of dry ice himself, and personally tossed each specimen in. Such a din of marketing all around, it's easy to be wilted by guilt or to rage at whoever made this place. But to watch how lobsters madly scramble, you have to bend close, look through your own shadow into the tank's dim algae light, where a few black beads fiercely eye back, grabbers and pincers clawing their way to the top of some little heap.
And for what? I suddenly have to ask, trembling, here, in the middle of my life.
Ooh, who's that poet?
Betsy Shull. And it's from a book, Late Psalm.
Well, now we will truly have to finish.
Yeah.
The titles and the authors are on the website, those that Philip and Tanya have mentioned, and I'm sure that on another day we can do it again. Philip is professor of English at University of Illinois, Philip Graham. He has some books he's written. They're pretty good. You go look for his stuff.
That's right.
And Tanya works out at Pages for All Ages Bookstore. And it's always great to have you here. We certainly appreciate
it. Thanks so much for having us.
Yes, thanks. We love it here. It's great.
A couple minutes here left before we go to the afternoon magazine. Also, between now and noon, still an opportunity for people to call in, make a pledge, and get a book. Standing by, I expect, in Pledge Central is Kim Cronick.
Yes, I'm here, David.
So can you tell us, just sort of roughly speaking, how many people we've heard from?
We've heard from 9 people who've called in at 217-244-9455, and they'll have their choice of a nonfiction or fiction book hardcover. All you need to do is make a $40 pledge to support WILL, and we'll give you that book as a thank you gift. You know, David, I love books almost as much as I love WILL radio.
And that's a lot.
And so what a great combination to have radio and books in one show, to have people who come in who can read this great book and poetry, people call in. You know, this is a great public service, and I want to ask people who have listened but not yet contributed to please become a member right now. We are trying to get new members. We need to increase our base as we keep those who've been friends for a while, and we appreciate their support. It's easy to make a pledge. You can use your Visa, MasterCard, Discover, or American Express. Maybe you're in your car on your cell phone. The number's 217-244-9455. If you're getting ready for lunch and you're at your computer, just do one more thing before you head out. Go to the website, will.uiuc.edu, and make a pledge at our online secure site. Or call right now and talk to one of our great volunteers at 217-244-9455. $40 is a basic membership, and we'll say thanks by giving you a book.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you very much. We want to thank everyone who's called in with their contributions. We also want to thank these folks who make this program possible, Bodywork Associates. This year, they're celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Programs here on AM 580 are also made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. That's it for us. We want you to stay tuned, because up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, two tax experts will be with us, Marty Verdick and Steve Winterstein of RSM McGladrey Incorporated. So if you've got questions about your Illinois or federal tax return, today's the day to tune in at 106 Central Time, because Marty and Steve can help. I'll welcome your telephone calls for the two of them following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. March wheat, 294.5, up 4.5. May, 302.25, up 3.25. March corn, 198.75, up 3.75.